disturb that sub-session of the session of the American Peace Conference, Quantum Social and Biological Peace. The first presentation is the title Science and the Metaphysics of Emergence by Ken Palmer. Ken Palmer?
Mm-hmm.
You have 40 minutes for the presentation and 10 for the discussion.
Okay.
I move away from you, so I don't make any problems.
So hello, my name's Kent Palmer, and I'm giving a talk on science and the metaphysics of emergence. And actually, this is a briefing on my research, partially on my research, my PhD research, which was done from 1974 to 82, and then subsequent results. I did my PhD at London School of Economics, and I had the title of the Structure of Theoretical Systems in Relation to Emergence. So, you know, I don't know who, you know, what the exact history of the concept of emergence is in terms of who, you know, who was doing research on it at that time, but you know, my research was some of the earlier research in the field, and I took off from the work of G.H. Mead, who wrote a book called The Philosophy of the Present. And in The Philosophy of the Present, he defines the concept of emergence. My approach to emergence in my dissertation was a little bit different than most people, which was to look at continental philosophy and particularly fundamental ontology, and to try to understand all of these different kinds of being that were being developed by continental philosophers. And basically what I, after a while looking at it, I realized that I could take Russell's theory of hierarchical types and apply it to continental philosophy to understand the different kinds of being that were being developed in continental philosophy. So that's what I did. The basic idea is that if you start looking at, you know, starting from Husserl and then going to Heidegger, Heidegger defines two kinds of being, which he calls present in hand and ready to hand. And basically, you can talk about those as what you might call pure being and process being. One of them is being that is unmixed with time, and the other one is mixed with time. And so being and time is basically about the relationship between these two modes of being. One outside of time, which is the traditional kind of being, and then the kind of being which I'm calling process being, but he called ready to hand, which is being mixed with time. Well, you know, traditionally, the being was a unitary concept that was a totality, and there was no idea that there were different modalities or kinds of being. And so once Heidegger opened up that door to there being different kinds of being, then people started producing all different kinds of concepts of being. And so you get Merleau-Ponty coming and basically trying to rewrite being and time in the phenomenology of perception. And when he rewrote it, he talked about that trying to give psychological, psychological explanation to what Heidegger is talking about, and he took it to pointing and grasping, that pure being is when you're pointing at something, and process being is when you're grasping it. So President Hand and Reading Hand, he talked about as being related to each other in terms of pointing and grasping. And then what happened is later Heidegger developed a further concept of time, of being, which he called being crossed out. And that has to do with the fact that once you differentiate two kinds of being, two modalities of being, then there's a there's the distinction between them. And that can't have the kind of being of the two kinds of being. So once you separate being into two parts, then there has to be a third kind of being. And Heidegger called that being crossed out. And Derrida took off from that point and defined difference as the relationship between differing and deferring. And I call that hyper-being. And then what happened was that Merleau-Ponty wrote The Visible and the Invisible, and in that he differentiates between these first three kinds of being and says there's a fourth kind of being, which he called wild being. And he defined wild being as the dialectic between what Heidegger was talking about in process being and what Sartre was talking about in terms of nothingness. Sorry, he defined hyper-being as the relation between process being and nothingness, and then went on to define hyper-being in that book. So the interesting thing about the kinds of being is that it's kind of like a stair step to nowhere, in the sense that as you're moving up these steps of the different kinds of being, what's happening is that it becomes harder and harder to think them, right? And there's less and less conceptual space as you're moving up, and so when you get to the fifth meta level of being, it's impossible to think it. Right, and in the Western tradition, thinking and being, I mean, it's a saying of Parmenides that thinking and being is the same. So once you can no longer think it, once it's no longer intelligible, it's not being anymore. And so you fall over, you run into this discontinuity at the fifth meta level of being, which is you run into existence, right? And you get out of being. Being is all about projecting upon the world. And the projection ends at the fifth meta level of being. So, at this transition of existence. So basically, you know, if you look at these meta levels of being, you know, you have this line here between pure being and beings, entities, things, times, events, whatever, all the specific stuff. All of the specific things. And Heidegger defines this thing called ontological difference, which is the difference between being and beings, right? Beings with an S, small b. Beings and being with a capital B. And so once you make that distinction of between being and beings, this ontological difference, then, you know, all throughout the tradition, it's been that being was one thing. But basically, through the work of Husserl, Husserl showed that there was this distinction between essences and ideas. And once you make that distinction between essences and ideas, then Heidegger formalized that in the relation between the present at hand and the ready to hand. And then once you've made that distinction in being itself as an intrinsic distinction of two different kinds of being, then the question becomes, how many of them are there? Are there infinite numbers of these in a hierarchy, or is there a finite number? And up until recently, I thought that there were only four kinds of being, and that was it. And so one of the things I'm going to get to is my own kind of discovery that there is a kind of being at the fifth meta level. But it's this interesting point that as you move up those meta levels of being, you reach this point of existence, and where it becomes unthinkable, and so that's a very important transition. So there's two discontinuities. There's the discontinuity of ontological difference, and there's the discontinuity of existence at the fourth meta level. Save that. Okay, so once you have understood that the different kinds of being, see, there's this split between analytical philosophy and continental philosophy, and one of the points of the split is the fact that in continental philosophy, it's all about exploring these different kinds of being, and of course, analytical philosophy is still in the mode where they only think that there's one kind of being, the pure being. So, basically what continental philosophy does is it tries to find phenomena that exemplify these other kinds of being, these higher levels of being. And but what they don't have is a structure to that, right? And so what Russell's theory of higher logical type and the idea of meta levels gives you is a structure to that. Once you know that the structure is the meta levels of being, you can just kind of jettison continental philosophy and you can discover it all for yourself, because all you have to do is take the word being and think to yourself, what is the next meta level up from pure being, and then what's the next meta level up? And because pure being is like the being of Parmenides, right? It's static, never changing. Whereas process being is like the being of Heraclitus, which is always in flux. And the beauty of Heidegger's presentation in Being and Time is he says these are equiprimordial. In other words, they're intrinsic parts of being. You don't have to choose between them, but actually in our experience, we're constantly moving between looking at things in terms of pure being and looking at things in terms of process being. And then as you go up these meta levels, you discover there are phenomena associated with hyper-being, and there are phenomena associated with wild being. But as you're going up, those phenomena become more and more rare. And one of the papers that I have shows that hyper-being level is associated with software. Software is an example of hyper-being. It's one of the first entities, cultural entities, that actually embodies that third meta level of being. So anyway, once you understand that there are these meta levels of being and they have their emergent qualities, and continental philosophies have been about exploring these different emergent properties, then you come to the point of my research, which was that for my PhD, was basically to say, okay, now what is emergence, right? And so I distinguish between two kinds of emergence, genuine and artificial emergence. And so the difference between genuine and artificial emergence is that in genuine emergence, you pass through all four of the meta levels of being. When the new thing comes into the world, it passes through all four of the meta levels of being to come into the world, and when it does that, because being is such a fundamental thing, it changes the world by going through all of those levels. But an artificial emergence is something which only goes through one level, two levels, three levels. It doesn't go through all four meta levels of being. And so this kind of little graphic here kind of tries to tell that story, which is that you can see that a genuine emergence is going to the center of the target. it's going to this fifth meta level. But the other, but the artificial emergence is peeling off at a different at the various levels of being, and so doesn't fully embody deep structural change to the world view. So that's kind of like where I got to in my dissertation about 1982. And what this affords is it affords a way of thinking about what emergence is and how fundamental it is as a phenomena, and how there are different levels of emergence. There's a striation to it. It's not just one thing, but there's these different levels of emergence, and at the different levels, it gets deeper and deeper into not just the world, but into our own existence by looking at these different levels. Let's see. I think I want to... What's this one? Okay. So, let's see. Where is this? Well, okay, I'll just stick with this. Okay, so this is another view of the same thing, but instead saying that okay, there's these different meta levels of emergence then, you know, and so you can talk about the different meta levels of emergence in and they correspond to the different meta levels of being. So like the part down at the bottom where beings are, you know, that's just flux or random change or undirected change or entropy. But if you go up to the first meta level of emergence, which is related to pure being, that's combinatoric and additive change, right? So an example of that, and now the idea here is that all of these first four meta levels of change are all going to be forms of artificial emergence. And so combinatoric and additive change is kind of like where you have a new car every year or a new stereo system every year. You know, fashion changing. In other words, nothing essential changes, but it's an appearance of newness, right, which is socially generated. And then the next meta level of emergence is a much deeper thing, which is that emergence itself becomes an event, right? And an example of that is kind of like built-in obsolescence or when new technology replaces old technology. There's an event where this technology no longer is valid because the technology has changed. You know, like there's a problem now of land-based phones because everyone has cell phones, right? As cell phones get better and better, people are going to stop having land-based phones, perhaps. And so there's a whole infrastructure there that's going to be displaced, perhaps, which was very important, but then is now less important. And that displacement is an event. It's something that happens in time. And it's deeper, that displacement of technologies is a deeper phenomena than just the new fashion or having a new car every year where you've already planned what new features you're going to add in every year for the next 10 years for a product. Then the next meta level of emergence is at the hyper-being level. And that, you know, as we go up these levels, what we're going to see is that they become harder and harder to think about. But the one way to characterize the hyper-being level I call hovering before possibilities. And that has to do with you know, you're looking out at various possible ways that you can go, and you're indecisive between those ways that you can go, but you're seeing panoramas of those possibilities. So an example of that is like concept cars, where they're building a model of a car that they will never build, and the only purpose of that car is to show you what the future might be. Someone mentioned that they were going to build a car for women, right, in the previous section. I mean, that's an example. They probably have a concept car for a car for women, but it could be that they'll never produce that car, right? And so the thing is that it just shows you these future possibilities for that particular artifact and opens up these vistas of possibilities. And so that's what's happening at the at that third level. It's kind of like when you talk about paradigm changes, you can see one paradigm or you can see the other paradigm, but you haven't actually entered into them. They're just different paradigms or different possibilities that are open up to you. And then this fourth meta level of emergence, which corresponds to wild being, is this thing about having chaotic propensities realized as actualities. And a good example of this is Deleuze's philosophy. I mean, Merleau-Ponty opened up, I mean, you know, if you talk about Derrida, like, fully explored the hyper-being level. But then Merleau-Ponty opened up the wild being level. And Deleuze is the first one to actually establish a philosophy in that level. And if you read Deleuze's philosophy, it's pretty clear that he's walking up these different meta levels in terms of difference. He's talking about difference at the different meta levels and establishing his philosophy at this fourth meta level of being. So Deleuze is a good example of this. And he has a lot of ways of talking about these chaotic propensities that are realized as actualities in his philosophy. But examples of this, I was trying to think of examples of this, and the two that came to mind are these ideas that have become popular recently of highly optimized tolerance and self-organized criticality. I mean, those two things are like duals of each other. One of them has to do with the like fires jumping barriers, and how at different times the fires will jump more barriers, the self-organized criticality is like if you have sand piles and avalanches in sand dunes, and highly optimized tolerance has to do with very complex mechanisms for containing change that break down. And the other one has to do with very simple mechanisms by which different bursts of change of different magnitude get started by very small changes. And so in both of those things, there's this idea there's these unrealized propensities in a system that get realized and actualized, and it can be a very slight modification to cause a whole new thing to happen. And so I think that those are examples of the wild being level. And then the idea is that when you go up to the fifth meta level of being, you get this you get genuine emergence. And so that's one thing that I've been thinking about. And the thing about ultra being, for my career thinking about this, I've shied away from this concept of ultra being. Because it has some very deep, if it exists, it has some very deep implications for our way of looking at the world. And some of those implications I don't like. And so, because you can associate it with things like poison and sin and evil, but it also has the opposite effect. It's like the concept of a pharmakon in the Greek. Whereas the pharmakon embodies the evil and is outcast from the community, but also the word pharmakon means healing. And so there's this ambiguity in ultra being of a kind of like extreme nihilistic opposites, that it can be like really bad or really good. And so, but what happened over time was that I started recognizing these, just applying this model of there's only these four kinds of being. And if you looked at my works, you'll see that I apply it to a lot of different things. And in fact, I kind of developed a field which I called ontomythology, where what I do is I go back and read the Indo-European tradition in terms of these kinds of being. And that started happening because I was reading about the work of Dumuzil and looking at the Vedas, and I realized at one point that the differences between the gods in the Vedas were these kinds of being. And once you realize that the differences between those gods are the kinds of being, you realize that this whole thing of continental philosophy is not new. In other words, these structures of being are like incredibly conservative within our worldview, and they've been there for a long time. And so then that led me to start looking at other Indo-European myth patterns, and I found that a lot of Indo-European myth can just be read as a handbook about the different kinds of being and what it is to live in a world with these different kinds of being. And what's great about that is that there's a that by reading the mythology of the Indo-Europeans as that kind of handbook, it gives these different kinds of being a lot of substance to them, because you're recognizing that different things like the caste structure in Greece or the pattern of the Indo-European gods across all of the different Indo-European societies is all talking about the structure of the worldview that we are in. And to us, you know, we're like fish within this ocean of the worldview, and it's hard for us to see. But you can see that in the mythology there are some very precise descriptions of that structure. So anyway, that became interesting to me, and as a way of elaborating on this idea. So now I want to talk about the what's happening at this fifth meta level of being. And basically, the view I had previously was that there's two fundamental interpretations of the fifth meta level if you consider it as existence. One of them has to do with the Buddhist concept of emptiness, and the other one has to do with the Taoist concept of void. That these, and there's a fundamental difference between these two positions that usually isn't brought out. A lot of times they're treated as if they're the same. But the Buddhists do not believe in the physical world. They believe everything is consciousness. And they deny that the physical world is there. And so emptiness is the nature of consciousness. Right? The Taoists, on the other hand, have exactly the opposite view. They believe that the natural world is all that exists, and that the social and consciousness are just examples of the natural world. These are extreme opposite views, but they come to a very similar orientation because through this concept of negation. Of their idea of emptiness. The Buddhists have this idea that the self is empty, and then in Mahayana Buddhism, everything is empty, and it's through that emptiness that interpenetration of things occur. And the Taoist, it's not as well developed as a tradition in many ways as the Buddhist tradition, but if you go back and you look at the original works in that tradition, and you'll see that the Taoists, they have this idea of emptiness as being the emptiness of a, not emptiness, the void, as being the usable absences in nature. You know, so in the Tao Te Ching and so forth, they'll talk about the bowl, it's only useful because there's an emptiness there, or the wheel is only useful because there's a void there. And so, and then they generalize that to being the nature of physical existence, and then they generalize that again to human action to say that human action should be non-action. So there's these two fundamental descriptions of existence as either empty or void, and but what's interesting about that is that we have to again ask this question: if there's these two fundamental interpretations of existence, what marks the difference between them? And what I realized was that, you see, in the lower meta levels of being, that's projection from the inside. But when you get to this fifth meta level of being, you're looking at projection from the outside. So what is being from the outside? We don't experience projection from the outside very often, but it's there as a possibility. So whereas all of the lower meta levels of being have to do with being in the world, as Heidegger says, you know, at the fifth meta level of being, we're looking at something like being out of the world as an external view. And that's what I think ultra being is. It's the externality of the projection of being as Dasein, by Dasein as being in the schema. And I gave a talk yesterday about my theory, general schemas theory. So I won't go into that. So So then it becomes a question. One of the things that I've always said about this ontology is that it's empirical, in the sense that if you can go out and find a new meta level of being, let's say, this opens the question, is there a sixth meta level of being? Is there something higher than this thing I'm calling ultra being? And for me, I'd say that's, you know, I'd again say, no, it's not. But it could be that over time we'll discover that there is something at that level that has to do with being. But I think that what happens is that at the fifth meta level of being, ultra being separates emptiness from void, and that at the sixth meta level, this distinction collapses and there's only existence at that level. Now, the importance of this ultra being is that this is the nature of emergence. It's of genuine emergence is when ultra being appears. And so, and what I'm discovering in my my recent research is that these things I'm calling schemas have the nature of ultra being. And the way that I'm thinking about that now is the fact that schemas are things like pattern and form and system and world. And what I was saying yesterday is that we need to consider those other schemas in order to give the schema system meaning. The point is that when things out in the world encounter our projection, they encounter it externally, right? Before they encounter these lower meta levels of being, and so the schema is like the surface tension. This ultra being is like the surface tension of the projection that the things out in the world, by generating anomalies against our projection, when they encounter our projection, they disturb the projections that we are foisting on to the things, and science is looking at those anomalies and trying to figure out what's really there. But that surface tension from the outside of the projection is, I think, the nature of this ultra being, and that's why it's important. And it's also genuine emergence, because that thing which it is encountering may be a genuinely new phenomena, for instance. You know, emergence has two different phases to it. It can either be from the inside as paradigm changes, right? Or it can be from the outside as a totally new phenomena appearing. Like a good example of that is superconductivity. It's something they ran into in the lab. They had no explanation for it. It took them 20 years to come up with the theory of Cooper pairs. It was just an utterly unexplained phenomena. Whereas you have like black holes, right? It was a totally theoretical idea, and it's only recently that they're starting to come up with phenomena out in the world, you know, in the cosmos, that they can associate with black holes. So emergence can come at us from these two different directions, but in both cases, I'd suggest that there's this there's this surface tension where the phenomena, whatever it is, encounters our projection. And what's interesting about black holes is that in the case of black holes, the phenomena itself as a theoretical thing, you know, you have the singularity inside of the black hole and you have the event horizon, and it's like a model of this unthinkable externality, because we can't think what the singularity is. It's a model of that encounter between the unthinkable and the projections, our intelligibility, where we try to think these phenomena. And so what we do in theory is we produce projections of this encounter between the thinkable and the unthinkable, and then maybe we find some phenomena out there like black hole that we can associate with black holes. On the other hand, you might have a phenomena like superconductivity, where it's just something that shows up in the lab and we have no explanation for it, and people deny its existence at first, you know, but ultimately they say, yes, it is doing this even though it shouldn't be doing this. And then slowly they try to work to find some kind of explanation for why that phenomena would exist. So I think that ultra being, if it does exist, is a very important concept that we should pay attention to, especially if, and I agree with your comment today, that the one way of transforming this society is to, instead of thinking of it as general systems theory, to say it's about emergence, right? It's about a general theory of emergence. And I like that because then you could say, well, I'm not just going to be stuck on the schema of systems. I'm going to apply all the different schemas to that, understanding what emergence is. And another reason I like it is that I just spoke in April to a conference on systems engineering research, and basically what I said to them was the analog of what you said today to the systems theorists, which was that we should consider systems engineering as emergence engineering. And the whole job of the systems engineer is to produce emergences, and that frees us from the schema of systems, and we can use other schemas like the schema of domain and form and pattern and world to manage that complexity of the things we're trying to build, because a lot of the systems we're trying to build today are really worldwide systems, and there's some question in my mind whether the schema system can encompass all that. So another way of looking at this is Okay. Another way of looking at this is that is to think about Western society, the Western worldview, in terms of nihilism. And the thing about nihilism is that what it is the production of artificial extreme opposites and dualities in the society. And where nihilism comes up is where you realize that these extreme opposites that we're producing all the time are really the same. So like the Democrats and the Republicans, I mean, those are nihilistic opposites gets produced in this society, but when you come right down to it, it's the incumbents in Congress that are the real power holders. They support themselves. It appears as if they're all fighting with each other, but actually they're all supporting each other as incumbents, and they're the true power holders in society. There's not that big a difference between them. And you can talk about that in terms of a lot of different things. For instance, there's a great book by Baudrillard called The Mirror of Production, and it talks about communism and capitalism having the same assumption that human life is all about production. And so once you make this assumption that human life is all about production, a lot of things flow from that. But we don't have to make that assumption that human life is all about production. We could think of human life in other ways. And so nihilism is basically the loss of meaning when you realize that the extreme opposites that you've produced, they collapse together. But there's a little trick to do with nihilism, which has to do with the fact that once you produce the dual and the anti-dual in a dualistic way of looking at things, like mind and body, the thing about dualism is that usually one side is supposed to trump the other. So like mind is supposed to trump body, or vice versa. And so there'll be dualism and monism are kind of the same in the sense that once the duals have been produced, then one of them is considered a monism, which tries to get rid of its anti-dual. Anyway, if you see what, as I do, that the Western worldview, the main thing it's about is producing nihilism. You have these myriad nihilistic opposites, but there's a secret communication between the nihilistic opposites through a third position, which is not apparent, which is this non-dual position. And there's someone named Loy who's written a book called Non-Duality that articulates this position very well. And non-dual does not mean monist. It means not one, not many, or not one, not two. So there's some position which is both not one and not two. And that's what emptiness is supposed to represent. That's what void is supposed to represent. There's supposed to be views of what non-duality is about. And so what happens is that, I always wondered about this, is what's the relationship between the non-dual core of the Western worldview and that non-dual core. Let's see, do I have that chart? I think I left that one. That non-dual core has to do with our fundamental values in the Indo-European tradition. The non-duals, they start with order, and then right, and then good, and then fate. Those concepts are non-dual, part of the non-dual core of the Western worldview. And the reason that that non-dual core is there is because it supports the communication between the two extreme duals that say we don't have anything to do with each other, we're completely separate from each other, but we actually through the back door are the same thing once you go into this non-dual way of looking at things. What happens when you get to the fifth meta level of being, which is very interesting, is that you get a flip. And the flip is that the non-duality becomes dual, and the dual becomes non-dual. And so where you have void and emptiness, those are two views of non-duality, but actually they're extreme opposites from each other. And what's separating them is ultra-being. Being was the thing that was dual at the lower levels, but now it's become a single thing, which is the distinguishing mark between emptiness and void. And I ran into someone on the internet just before I came here named Guz, and he has a site called emptysets.com or .org. And he talks about emptiness as being an infinity of null sets. And so I realized by looking at his web page that I could define void as an infinity of null masses. And we have built into our way of looking at things a set way of looking at things and a mass way of looking at things. And but like all of our mathematics is based on sets. And so the another way of looking at things is a mass way of looking at things. And our society hasn't developed that. So like in our mathematics, we don't have sets and masses as fundamental mathematical objects. We only have sets. And so if you had a mathematics which would have that duality between set and mass all the way up from the foundations, it would be a very different structure to mathematics. And this is where emergence comes in, because sets are different kinds of things grouped, bracketed together in a set. So the emphasis is on difference. But on mass, you have a whole bunch of instances that are identical, but when you put them together in a mass, they have emergent properties that they don't have on their own. So the mass way of looking at things encapsulates the this phenomena of emergence. And so we should have a way of switching back and forth between set ways of looking at things and mass ways of looking at things. And we have that built into our language as count and non-count ways of talking. So, but we don't have that built into our mathematics. And if we developed a new mathematics which had the mass duals for all of the set-like things, then we would have a way of dealing with emergence that we don't have now, because emergence is the transformation from the set way of looking at things to the mass way of looking at things and then back. GUZ, G-U-Z. It's, I think it's emptysets.com or emptysets.org. He just talks about the infinity, this infinity of empty sets. And I've been working with this duality between sets and masses for quite, for a couple of years now. And I realized that these two ways of talking could be applied to this emptiness and void distinction. Okay. Here's the way it goes. A set is a bracket, right, around different things. So you can't have two of the same kind of thing in a set. So sets are all about differences, and the differences are distinguished by the properties of the things that are in that set. So there's a book called The Discovery of Things by... what is the name of that book? It's something like The Discovery of Things. And it's about Aristotle and how his postulation is that all of the pre-Aristotelian philosophers were all mass philosophers. So Plato and the pre-Socratics are all mass philosophers. Oh my gosh. I'm the one that's doing this. So, let's see, where was I? So the sets are all about difference. Okay, now masses are instances that are all the same, like molecules of water, and you put them all together in an aggregate, and they have properties like waves and tidal waves and waves that the individual instances don't have. Okay, so a mass way of looking at things is all about identity, and a set thing is all about difference. But the in sets, the grouping is empty. There's nothing to the grouping. It's just a bracketing. Whereas in a mass, the grouping has properties that the individual things don't have. So this distinction between, and the way I got onto this was I read a book about Indian logic that said that Sanskrit and the logic developed in India was all mass-based instead of set-based. And there's a fairly famous book that talks about Chinese philosophy, which says it's mass-based. And if you looked at the Chinese language, it's a mass-based language. But I didn't realize that Sanskrit was mass-based. And what's interesting is that there's a logics associated with set and mass. So the logic associated with sets are syllogisms, the logic we have. There's a different logic associated with masses, which is a pervasion logic. Instead of universals, it uses boundaries. And Buddhist logic is all pervasion logic, and Indian logic is pervasion logic. And we completely miss out on pervasion logic. So not only should there be at the foundations of our mathematics this duality between mass and sets, but there should be we should have logics developed, a syllogistic logic and pervasion logic both. So So anyway, I think it's significant here, this if you think of emptiness and void in terms of mass and set, then you can see that this is a fundamentally different approaches to phenomena, but at a very deep level, because we're talking about it showing up here at the fifth meta level of being, which is a fairly deep meta level. See what this says. So empty ultra being, I'm just repeating, ultra being separates the emptiness from the void. The non-duality is dual at the fifth meta level of being, just as the dual becomes non-dual when seen from the outside. So within the projection process, there's this production of dualities, but when it gets to ultra being, there's like no room for duality anymore, and the dualities collapse into something which is like a non-dual. But when those dualities at the lower level collapse into something that's like a non-dual, then non-duality becomes dual. And you get this difference between emptiness and void, which is shown up in the tradition as this difference between Taoism and Buddhism. And there's a whole interaction that happened in Tibet and in China between the Buddhists and the Taoists. And there's a lot of... Once the Chinese actually understood well what the Buddhists were talking about, they realized that Taoism and Buddhism were different. And I'd recommend to you a poet called Stonehouse. And he was a Zen monk who was also a Taoist. And in his poetry, you can find lines where one line is an emptiness line, the next line is a void line, the next line is an emptiness line, the next line is a void line. So within that tradition, they became very sophisticated in their understanding, eventually, of the relationship between emptiness and void. And in fact, Korean Buddhism traces itself back to Stonehouse, Korean Zen Buddhism. So anyway, this is like a completely different way of looking at things that we're not used to in the West, because normally we don't go up to these higher meta levels of being. But there's other traditions, like the Buddhist tradition and the Taoist tradition, where they develop these non-dual ways of looking at things, which we need to try to understand, because they can give us a new insights into some of our problems living in a society which is all about generating dualisms, and nihilistic ones at that. Okay, so I think I'll leave it at that. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Okay, I have a handout here of my abstract and a small elaboration of this idea. And on there is my website, and you can look at my writings on my website. Sorry? Well, it's on this piece of paper. I'll give you that.
You're going into
this. Yeah, I'm going to. And it's on this first sheet here. Arconic.net. Any other questions? I know this is kind of strange stuff. Thank you.
I saw many connections and many analogies in there to various different practices and belief systems. And I've actually been looking a lot myself into ancient philosophies and Buddhism and Vedas. Appreciate your knowledge of that. I was wondering if you had run across the work of Ken Wilber.
Oh, sure. Okay, there's something called Orientalism, and Orientalism is basically projecting our ways of looking at things on other cultures, and this is like a danger, and it's something that our academic communities have been engaged in from the very beginning. And so we got to be very careful here in making distinctions in a way which is true to the traditions we're studying. You know, like we're talking about Zen Buddhism, and for instance, or Taoism. In Tibet, they have something that I've been reading about lately called, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's called Ar Dzogchen, which is a heretical form of Buddhism, but has this, what I'm talking about, this differentiation between the void and emptiness built into it. And that's why it's heretical, is because it goes beyond emptiness and talks about the void. But anyway, it's good to learn their vocabulary, their way of distinguishing these things, and not immediately just read it back into our way of looking at things, which a lot of scholars do. And I'll give you an example from history about this, is that the Greeks, you know, they had being, and but then the Greek tradition was picked up by the Muslims in Islam, and in Arabic there was no being. And so when they started studying the Greeks, they learned to differentiate what they called wajud, which meant existence, from what the Greeks were talking about, which was being. And so when they understood what the Greeks were really getting at, they understood that they didn't have being in their language. And so they invented a technical term from Arabic called kun, which means to make something, rather than wajud, which means to find something. They created this technical term to differentiate what the Greeks were talking about from what they had in their tradition. And then what happened was that when that Arabic scholarship came back into the West, and they were doing translations, there was no word for wajud, right? So in Latin, they made up the word existence. And so now we have in our philosophy, the concept of existence is an important concept, but that's imported from a language that had no being. And so existence has always been there within our tradition as a kind of background concept. And what happened was that, you know, with Heidegger and Kierkegaard and Sartre, they tried to take this background concept and bring it to the fore and see things in terms of existence rather than being. But in doing that, they're still seeing things mostly in terms of being. Even though they're talking about existence, they're still seeing things in terms of being. And so it's very interesting to compare that to what, say, the Buddhists are talking about in emptiness and what the Taoists are talking about in void, because it's a much purer view of what wajud is, what existence is. So anyway, it's something that you might want to look into yourselves. Any other questions? Okay.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
All right.